This is the Talking Split Podcast.
Coaches, welcome back to the Talking Split Podcast. I am Rob Coulter. With me, I have the woman who has only just regained her voice after being back on court this weekend, Zoe Carr. Welcome to the podcast, Zoe.
Thank you for having me.
Always a pleasure. And the man making his podcast debut, or with us anyway, I'm not entirely sure what you've done in previous lives. The man that is universally acknowledged as an upgrade over Ash Arnott, Darren Best. Welcome to the podcast, bestie.
Thanks for having me. I'll definitely good to be on here. I'll listen to it often, so nice to be able to contribute.
Excellent. Mate, first podcast, so we've got to get into a little bit of about who you are and what you've done and those kinds of things for the listeners out there. Give us a rundown. Where did you sort of grow up playing? How did you get involved in basketball, coaching, the pathway, all that sort of stuff? What do you got?
Sure. Basketball for me, I was a late starter. I was a rep soccer player up until sort of 15. And then I started playing basketball, helped that I grew significantly. So, started playing at Cranbourne just through seeing an ad in the paper. I was actually a Berwick, Berwick rep soccer and saw a Cranbourne Comets rep basketball tryout in the paper. So, I went to that, played there for a couple of years and found out that it wasn't very good. So, made the move to Tigers and got with Nick A there basically. And he just improved me rapidly. And before I know it, I was off to college. And after that, played a little bit overseas and yeah, then got into Queensland, QBL, and that's when I really started to get into my coaching and some time at BQ and a DOC up there before going to work for BTAS in a HP role. And then Cranbourne, which is now Casey, they obviously improved a lot and asked me to come back to take charge of that. And then, yeah, that went really well. And here I am now at BV. So it's been sort of come full circle in all respects.
Bestie showing his age that he saw an ad in the newspaper.
Yeah, and they were Cranbourne Comets at the time as well. They went through a couple of branding changes since that time, but even though, I mean, it's nice of you to say they improved and then they got you in. Whereas you know there's a fair chance that you had a little bit to do with that improvement in there as well. It's that rep program is a very strong one across Victoria at the moment.
Well, we improved more.
There's a line in there somewhere. It's great to have you on the podcast and obviously a wealth of experience that comes with this as well. It's always great to get different opinions from various people around the place as well. And your background speaks for itself. Like you've literally been through every sort of stop, I suppose, along the way from the junior rep to the senior rep and all those kinds of things along the way. And it's always interesting to hear people coming from a soccer background as well. Did you think that helped you as a basketballer, like the soccer background?
Maybe with some coordination. Like I said, I went from probably about 5'10 to like 6'6", 6'7" in about a year. So yeah, that sort of helped with basketball.
That also helps too, yeah. Yeah.
Not great for the clothes and shoes, Bill.
Like no. True. Very true, very true. Hey, one thing that Bestie did manage to achieve though, one athlete going to the COE. In his time in Basketball Victoria, in Jensen Bragge, who is about to take a scholarship, one more than Ash Arnott, just quietly. But also, Zoe, you've had another athlete from Vic Country just get a COE scholarship. Take us through that for us.
Yeah, Sienna Harvey, born and bred in Wodonga and has recently, or over the last couple of years, relocated to Geelong to attend Western Heights, where we have our hub lead, Dave Herbert. So she's doing has done a lot of work there, and a lot of the coaches down there have done a lot of work, which is great. She was a special kid and a special athlete, just sort of knowledge and time beyond her years. So it's really exciting to see and really good for her mum too, who still lives in Wodonga, so now she's probably, by going to the COE, a bit closer to home than she is in Geelong. So that's really good. It's really exciting and really impressive too that she's been able to be identified and managed to obtain this scholarship, having not been able to attend a national championships due to the two lockdowns. It's a really good lesson. Vili was down when we were open at the start of the year and came to a VMPP session and was obviously impressed by Sienna. And I'm not even sure Sienna knew, as bad as this might sound, who Vili was or why she was there. She just walked on court and trained how she always trains. And I think it's a really good lesson for a lot of athletes that you just never know who's watching. You never know what film's going to be sent somewhere. You just never know. And even coaches now, where your coach is now. You might have in under 14s. You don't know where they're going to end up. You might circle back and meet them up in under 18s for a state team or something like that. So, you know, it's a good lesson of making sure you always are giving everything you can at every session, regardless of who you think is there.
Yep. I mean, Darren's a great example of that. You know, has been in different states, has seen kids at national championships, has seen kids at Casey, and is now in a role where he's potentially going to have to select Casey kids.
Yep.
So your demeanour at that club level can impact everywhere, and it's not as if coaches don't talk. Like, it's the amount of times coaches between them will say, look, this kid might be coming to your trials, here's X, Y, and Z on them, or can you have a look at this kid for us as a different set of eyes too? Like, I mean, Bestie, how often did you used to talk to other DOCs and people around the place when you were in those types of roles?
Yeah, or if nothing, just from a courtesy perspective to let you know sort of what's going on with permission to trains and stuff like that. But I think it's just you're always of being evaluated. No matter what you do, how you act, how you behave when you're on the court, on the bench, somebody will see and somebody will report it somewhere, definitely in Victoria. That's for sure.
Yeah, there's no shortages of phones down here to send that message across as well. So it is a fantastic, I mean, people that have listened to the podcast regularly would know that I'm a little bit hypocritical of the word pathway in general, because it doesn't always marry up with where people, like Bestie's a great example, came in late as a late developer and had his own pathway that doesn't necessarily stand as your prototypical one. But Sienna is a kid that went to under 12 Jamboree, came through all the skills days, came through everything, did that Vic Country pathway. Like, I remember we were in Shep a couple of years ago.
Academy camp.
Doing an academy camp and helping out with an association coaches course. And the buzz around that camp was, everyone's got to watch this girl. Mm. Like, she's pretty special. She's wise beyond her years, good skill set. And the thing that, like, I think we all appreciated was just how much she loved it.
Yeah.
Like, genuinely loved the game and would get other people involved and talk. And she was a hive of activity the whole time.
Yeah, I think I've said to her on numerous occasions, you know, when you get to the – if you keep working and do the right thing and you make it to the level where there's photographers at games, you're going to have the best action shots, because she's just consistently got just this massive smile on her face. Like, I remember when I was playing, the action shots I got were horrific. Like, I would put, because everything was hard. So I always had this like winced look on my, or painful look on my face, whereas she's just got this smile the whole time. Doesn't matter what she's doing. She just loves it. And it's, yeah, it's rare you get the Mike McHugh triple of his talent ID, but she's certainly that.
Yep, absolutely. I think if you go through the old film of me playing, you just assume it's in slow motion the whole time. And it says, no, that's in real motion. That's just how fast I moved, unfortunately. And not much has changed since, it turns out.
Was that on a projector?
It was on a projector. Two massive film reels that you can just roll through. So the topic for the podcast this week came from Talking Split superfan Daniel Giancino, who wrote in and said, look, we are coming into this grading time of year. Can you talk about how coaches should be tackling grading? And, you know, anyone that's seen the VJBL grading map, and we'll talk about the domestic stuff in a little bit as well, but the VJBL grading map is, it's a different beast altogether. Like, you look at that thing and it's like it's been designed by Rain Man. Like, there are lines and numbers and you know, if this happens by less than this, but then you get that, then it's a full moon and it's blowing a westerly at the time, then that's your crossover. But for the most part, it does actually tend to work out fairly well, I do find. So we are talking grading. It's, you know, again, I'm coaching again this year, so any good ideas that come from you too, I will be stealing that and using it for my team as well. But Bestie, you've just finished up as a director of coaching over the last number of years. What was your message to coaches going into this time where they've just picked their team and they're about to start grading for the first time?
Well, I think the first thing is, you know, and this might be a little bit too late for some people, is when you go in and accept a coaching role, is knowing what are your KPIs for success. And this is one of the things I talk about often when I do a coaching course for people, is you wouldn't step into a job of employment without knowing what is actually determining your success. So I think there's a lot of coaches that step into a job, even if, you know, they're tapped on the shoulder during a trial, that don't ask that question. And you should know before the season even starts what's required of your team, what's expected of your team, and that will help you adjust accordingly. At Casey, we had different things for different teams. Obviously, one's teams are a bit more performance-based, so, you know, we would obviously want to try and grade as high as possible, but different teams with maybe an all-bottom age team would have different focuses always going along with the, you know, with the skill acquisition side of things. But I think that's the most important thing. And if the coach is listening, if you haven't had that yet, there's still time before your first game, I would definitely be hitting up whoever's in charge of me saying, what is actually determining my success in this group?
Yep. And it's not easy because it is different. And, I mean, age groups alone will dictate that a little bit as well. Like under 12s, especially over the last 2 years, a lot of these kids haven't had a lot of time on court playing domestic basketball and being able to get into a pathway necessarily as well. So that may look a little different in the younger age groups, where we are seriously talking skill lack in those under 12, under 14 type age groups, whereas your 16s and 18s, they're kids that have been in your program for potentially 6 to 8 years. You've got a rough idea on what the competition looks like, I feel like, at that stage. Like, you know who the other good teams are and who the other good kids are in that age group. And you've hopefully worked your kids through your own system to know what it's going to look like for those kids. So you can have a little bit more of an understanding, I suppose, in that 16s and 18s groups where you should actually fit, I feel like, is really important. What about you, Zoe? You've done this role before. What would you be telling your coaches this time of year?
Very similar to what Bestie says, you know, it does adjust depending on who you're talking to, like which teams you're talking to. But I also am a massive believer, you mentioned the grading map. The grading map allows you to grade, I don't know, I think it's only happened, I've been involved in VJBL for maybe 10 years, I'd say, maybe a bit more. And I think I've only seen it once hurt a team or not have a team grade where they should have graded. It gives you the opportunity to, you know, if athletes are injured pre-Christmas, to get it together and then grade where they should be grading after Christmas, all that sort of stuff. So I do think the grading map is good enough to not have to worry so much about, you know, putting in all your sidelines and baselines and 8 offenses and all that sort of stuff. I think there's still room to continue to play the long game and still develop whilst going through grading. Obviously, if you're a fringe VC team, you know, and you really want to make VC, then, you know, maybe your decision on what you're going to do changes. But I would also then counter that with, you know, if you are fringe VC, do you want to be in VC? Because that becomes now a really long, long season for you and for your athletes. So if it happens, great, but I wouldn't be, you know, sitting 3 kids for an entire game just to win that game, just to make VC, because then you're going to end up in that exact position every week. So play all your kids, get a good idea, because that's the, I suppose, one of the biggest things I would say. Don't sit kids just to win games. It starts your season off in such a bad – on a bad foot, you know, and ultimately they've still got until, I guess, grading phase 2 to decide if they want to move clubs as well. So, I'd just make sure everyone gets a good go. You start to get a really good idea, and you will fall at your level. Like I said, I think I've only seen it once where it didn't work, and that was due to not getting a pre-grading game when that team should have. So that's a different beast. So trust the grading map, trust your athletes. If you're good enough, you will land in VC if that's what you're looking for. If you're not, you will find your level.
I think
I truly believe that if you're 1 or 2 players away from, you know, maybe being injured or unavailable from not being able to make your desired grade, if it is VC, then you're probably not a VC team anyway.
Yeah.
Absolutely. No, and it's bang on, I think. Like, how many times have we seen it? Where, and I've seen it, like at 2 clubs I've been at, where the second team has made VC before Christmas, then hasn't won a game.
Yeah.
And it's like they've just got lucky on a grading map. It's a good crossover at the right time. They were good enough to win it, but then it all went pear-shaped from there, and that's a rough year.
And like, don't get me wrong, someone has to be in that position. You know, we can't have all of them sit on top of the ladder. That just doesn't work that way. But so if you are that team that makes that sort of last couple of positions in VC or VGL1 or whatever level it is, change your focus on what is, you know, successful to you. You know, a win becomes your athletes. I mean, I agree with this with everything, but if you are win-loss focused, just change what your win is. So your win could be executing X play through its entirety 4 times throughout the game, or
4 stops in a row,
how many times we get, whatever. Just change the goalposts as to what you find successful, because ultimately, whilst we sit here as coaches and say, play the long game, make it all about perform, long term and all that sort of stuff, don't worry about winning, kids still want to win. So you need to find a way to show them that even though the scoreboard's saying they're losing, they're still winning.
I think a really important part of this too is exactly what Darren was talking about before. We have a clear expectation of what this is going on, what the KPIs are. That also has to be relayed to your vital parties in all of this, which are the parents.
Yeah.
There's no point walking in and saying, I've been told by my director of coaching, we're taking a long view and we're going development with all of this, and the parents are up in arms saying, what's going on? We're losing games left, right and centre because you're playing all the kids equally and you're giving everyone an opportunity, which, you know, doesn't sit well
with
everyone.
We've been fundraising for 14 clubs.
Yeah, exactly. Like, that's okay, that's still 4 years away in under-12s. Like, that may not be the most appropriate way to do it. So it is difficult. The goalposts need to change. But as long as everyone's on the same page with that, and that is coaches as well as parents, and that message you would hope, if the parents are across it and understand it as well, filters down to the players. Now everyone has a really clear goal in mind. Mm. And, I mean, Darren made the point before, like with your bottom age team, those goalposts are very different. There's probably no expectation to make VC in that space. Your job will probably be the best two or three kids. Speaking generally, the bottom age teams are usually around about the threes, give or take. Your best bottom age kids might be in the ones or the twos because they are at that level where they can compete there, no problem. But your job now as the bottom age coach is to develop the athletes. It's not about trying to win games with those kids. You might have a couple of long-termers in there that you sit there and say, look, they're not ready now, but, you know, in 5 or 6 years' time, we think this could be a kid that can be really valuable to the sport. So trying to find that balancing act and communicating with the parents, here's the approach we're taking. That can save you a lot of dramas and so many arguments with parents who have got one view as to what's going on, but obviously there's a different world out there as well.
Yeah.
It's not easy.
And I think it's really important. And Darren, you would have had experience with this. You know, you talk about your different levels that you've got for your teams, depending on who it is, you know, performance for the higher teams, development for the lower ones. And then as the DOC, you know, you've got to back that. So, you know, if the development team starts to lose or doesn't win many games or whatever that might be, as the DOC, you cannot come in onto that coach and start, you know, putting pressure on them to win games. Like,
correct.
Whatever it is, you've got to stick with it and back them. And if you are a club or a DOC that says, we're winning all our games all the time, well, okay, like that's what you're doing. But if you tell them at the start, you know, I want you to develop these kids by next year. I want to be able to see at least four of them making the ones or something like that. You've got to back that coach. And if they are struggling, jump in and help them. Jump on the bench and help them. Come to their practice and help them. The last thing you want to do or should do is start pressuring that coach after you've just changed the goalposts.
Well, you end up losing them at the end of the season as well as the coach, which no one wants. So I think going back to what Rob said, I'm not sure how each association goes, but we'll talk about Casey because, you know, that's where I developed everything. But we had a parent book that had all of those things in it that had, you know, even some guidelines around playing time for some of the younger age groups. And I truly believe under 12s have got a responsibility to make sure that those kids want to come back first and foremost. But, you know, that sort of clears some of that up also for the coaches knowing. And I would say exactly what you just said, Zoe, to the lower developing coaches, you know, we want to see this kid in this team hopefully projected for the following season. And that's really what determines your success or not, you know, rather than wins or loss in those lower teams.
Yep.
Absolutely. And there are so many resources out there for coaches to tap into as well, whether it be your director of coaching, whether it be your age group head coach. And generally speaking, most clubs, age group head coaches are probably more experienced than most. So they have a little bit more knowledge as to what other coaches are going through. Tap into that. Don't become really insular in your grade. And it can happen because everyone gets really consumed with, we've picked our team, we've got, you know, one or two training sessions and maybe a practice game before we have to grade in 2 weeks' time. I'm only going to worry about me and my team rather than trying to integrate and make sure that you are doing the right thing by the athletes by working with what the club's direction is. And that's a really important part of it. If the club is going down a development focus, well, you better be developing as well because that train will leave the station with you or without you on it if you're not. So making sure you are tying in with everyone else, talk to other coaches, find out what they've gone through. Talk to the coach that had that group last year. Like if you've got a bottom age 14s team, talk to last year's bottom age 14s coach and find out what they went through. Where were the teething errors? What was the really low-hanging fruit that you managed to get through quickly that you could get done that actually developed your athletes a little better? And I think that's something that gets forgotten a lot is those conversations around, well, someone else has gone through this beforehand.
Yeah.
Like, what can we do now to at least help along with that a little bit?
I think some of the best advice, though, thinking back on my time in the VJBL, I remember being in the VC grand final on a Friday night, and then that, so not the following Sunday, but the Sunday after, trials had started. And I just felt just burnt out a bit like, oh, we're starting again already. And, you know, so I think as coaches, you know, and obviously we shouldn't have that problem, I guess, at the moment because we haven't been on court, but for following years or what, you know, if we happen to get a full year's worth of basketball in the next year, make sure you take some time to just relax and get away from it. And then when you come back into it, you have to go in with a brand new mindset. This is a brand new team. Because I know when I came in after that, I carried the mindset, the expectations, all of that from the team I just had where we'd made the final into the next season. And they were a brand new group. I was at a different club and they didn't know my language, my expectations, anything like that. And it actually, I think, set us back a couple of weeks. So give yourself that time to just switch off, then switch back on, and it's a fresh start once you hit grading.
I think part of it too is, and every club and association will run this a little bit differently. And Darren, I'm keen to get your thoughts on this because this is something I think you guys did really well at Casey, is there was a lot of consistency across the program. Like the under-18s coach knew what the under-12s coach was doing. There was a style of play that went through the club. So this time of year, it was actually a lot easier for coaches because you're not trying to reinvent something or you're not trying to sit there and say, what's going to work with this group? Am I going to have to create a new offense that's going to suit them? There were some building blocks in place. It's like, well, look, if everything falls down, you can still run what you need to run, you know, in June next year. But for grading, there's some things that we at least want to have in place that every kid knows so that every age group is at least ahead of where everyone else will be in that space. How did you find that, Darren, like with the sell across to all the coaches as well of having a style of play across the club? That and did that make a difference to you guys in grading, did you feel?
Yeah, so I guess the first thing is I was probably a little bit lucky in that when Casey approached me, they said, you know, we've got to the point where we're at and we're happy for somebody to come in and do whatever they want to get it to the next thing. So prior to me starting, you know, I think the most I'd ever had in VC ever was maybe three teams. And obviously last year we had nine. So very quickly it went up. And we had to jokingly talk about it a little bit. You're either in or you're out to our coaches. So we said, this is what we're doing. If we might not be for you, if that's the case, you can sort of move on. And we did have some coaches leave. We had some coaches come in from other clubs that really loved it because they were supported with stuff. But the biggest thing for us was in grading was we had a club-wide press breaker. Mm. So the kids won't lose. And it's sad that we have to talk about that as something that has to be addressed in grading. But, you know, particularly in the younger age groups, and some of this will be addressed now with the size 5 ball front of 12s, it's not such an issue with 16s and 18s because you can throw it over the top of a press. But the fact that, you know, every team you're rocking in and you're playing these other associations that are, you know, diamond press or, you know, whatever it is, just to have that club-wide, didn't have to learn it, just practice it. So every year the kids coming back knew it, had a huge impact straight away on grading.
Yep.
Massive.
It is, and that's one of the biggest things. Like, I think every coach will probably go in with a similar mentality of, let's get our defense set first. Like when you get a new team, you want to get the defense sorted. You know, we've all seen the Garnett ads, the defense is the backbone and all that sort of stuff, which is accurate. If you can get that sorted, well, the rest of it will take care of itself. And I do find that a lot of teams put in presses first rather than nailing down maybe that half-court man, yeah, which is probably going to serve you better, I would suggest, in the long term. But exactly to what you're talking about, Darren, like we see so many games won and lost in the full court, especially in the younger age groups, like 12s and 14s in particular. Like that thing is like a turnover machine. Like by the time the ball hits the court, there's like four kids running at them and it's just like, hey, you know what, take the ball. Like I can't deal with this. So just a little bit of structure helps. And I mean, you hit the nail on the head though. It's frustrating we have to talk about this. Like, we shouldn't have to put that in. Like, we should be able to sit there and say, well, look, one, our kids are well-skilled enough. Two, our kids have a good enough IQ. But three, we're not going to see someone trying to get a short-term winning grading, I think, is the most important one out of all of those.
Well, it's like the zone ban. We shouldn't have to have that in, but we do. And I remember years and years ago watching a boys team who had one and admittedly was a gun, but the rest of the team was okay, but they zoned all the way through and made VC and did all of that. And then as I think this was under 12s and under 14s, but then once it start that really good player as we got to 16s and 18s just fell away, and I'm not even sure he plays anymore because he couldn't defend, he had no concept of accountability, like all that sort of stuff. It's really disappointing that we have to have these rules, I guess, in. But, I mean, here we are. And yeah. from a 16s point of view, it's and 18s, it really sucks that in this time the coaches need a zone offense because they'll be 40 minutes zoned for 40 minutes in grading, just to grade. I just wish we could get to a place where zones were used. I'm not saying they have no place in the game, they do, but I just wish we'd get to a place where they were a change up and not the norm.
Absolutely. Look, I have to plead guilty here. Unfortunately, I have rolled out a 1-3-1 zoning grading before where I just thought, look, I will take a short-term hit on this one and potentially try and win a game. But I do agree with you. Like, we do have to be mindful too. Are we setting our teams up for the long-term success by trying to implement some things that will hold them in good stead throughout the year, or are we going the short-term win to try and grade? And, you know, I don't know necessarily the grading side of things is the best way to do it. And again, guilty as charged, but... You know, if we can at least get a message out here that, look, try and develop your athletes at the moment. And there's a massive time for skill development now too. Like, in particular now in Victoria where kids have been on the floor for, what do we call it, maybe 6 months out of the last 2 years. Mm. Like, they've rarely been on court. We have to continue to push the concepts and the skill development of our athletes rather than necessarily the structure. Yeah. I think that's really important. Darren, what would you sort of suggest, like, if you had a two-hour training session, what sort of timing would you implement for skill development, for concept work, for team-based stuff? Like, what would your split be roughly of a training session?
Well, I think, you know, the just on those three alone, most people go with your sort of one-third split, you know, so one-third for skill, one-third for concept, one-third for gameplay. But it's not a definitive line because they always cross over. So, you know, doing skill work on zero or, you know, on the spot is, you know, has a place for sure to get a level of proficiency to understand what's required. But very quickly, you've got to move into some sort of games approach, whether it's 2-on-1 or 2-on-2 or whatever. But that could also be a concept. So I would say gold standard's probably the one-third sort of thing. However, it's never in isolation. You know, it's always going to be together. But if we were to break it down between, if we're talking sort of offense and defense, for me, 2 hours session for junior ages, lengthy. So I would be trying to incorporate some of my defensive concepts into some of my warm-up stuff. So maybe it's closeouts on zero into something, and then it might progress into a bit of a skill with a closeout into a layup or something like that. But then if it comes to offense, the first thing I'd be dealing with is floor balance and receiver principles. Like, I think that would be probably the first and thing I'd be spending time on for several months, I would say. Yeah.
Oh, a man that likes small-sided games and game concepts. Oh, Darren, a man after our own heart. Oh, I love this. No, but it's genuinely accurate. With a lot of our kids, they potentially haven't played a whole lot where they haven't had to make decisions. They certainly have their skill set, haven't had their skill sets tested a lot, where they have to make a decision under pressure with time and space being an issue, defense coming at them from potentially different angles as well. It's going to be difficult for these kids. So we do have to be mindful that we are efficient with what we do with our training sessions. We don't want to be gifted a full court potentially by a club that says you've got from 8 till 10 a.m. And you have a full court and you only use half of it. Mm. Like, there's going to be everyone else walks in and says, oh man, we could have been in earlier, or we could use that, or can we just jump on and shoot? And before you know it, you've lost control of everything. So making sure you know what your resources are that you have available to you and using them. So if you have an assistant coach, great. You've got that basket. I've got this basket. Here's what we're going through. Get them back playing again. Get them used to making decisions, doing all the fun stuff that we know that our kids are probably going to struggle with to start off with. But similar to what you were talking about too, Darren, we want to have it to a point where just because you're doing an offensive drill and it might be games approach or have some sort of defense, doesn't mean you don't talk about the defense at all. We have to make sure we're coaching both at the same time. And here's where the assistant coach comes in very, very handy, because it's like, well, when you're designing your session plan, who's got what? Like, who's emphasizing what? Zoe, if you're taking the defensive side of things, I'll take the offensive side of things. Darren can take something else on top of that, making sure that he gets the feedback, so to speak. So you might be looking at your structure, I'll look at my structure, Darren gets the feedback. Now you've got all bases covered. So just the planning to make sure that our kids are getting what they need, but our coaches are actually active in that space is really important too.
Yeah, for sure. Slightly off topic, Darren, what would you say is the ideal amount of time for a training session for junior athletes?
So are we saying junior athletes is under 18 and under?
Yep.
Yeah, 90 minutes.
Yeah, I'm the
same. I feel like I can get done what I need to in 90 minutes, providing, you know, obviously the last couple of years I've coached 18s, that they get in before the session starts and do a Casey Ware club-wide warm-ups, muscle activation stuff. They had to do all that before they got on the court. So when they hit the floor, they were ready to go. But I think about 90 minutes. 2 hours does get pretty long, and you find yourself doing lots of shooting, which is good, definitely. You know, we always need to do more shooting. But as from a teaching standpoint, I think sort of the 90 minutes is good. And if you do have a two-hour slot, I would be making sure to put in lots of shooting periods in that. But I think one of the things when you talk about, you know, assistants and being in state positions, you've got two of them and a development coach, and you've got all these coaches everywhere. You might not necessarily have that from a rep perspective. But definitely with the older age groups, and you can do this with the younger age groups too, though, is if you come up with your perhaps consequences or penalties for certain things and reinforce that, the players can actually start to lead that themselves. I know, you know, one of the ones for me is a missed block out has always either been it's a burpee or just three quick defensive slides once the play ends and then get back into the play. And funny story, I'm coaching at a national.
Hold on.
Sound effects, Darren.
Story time.
But they're a funny one. Coaching at the Nationals. So we've gone through all of our prep. You know, this is when I was coaching a state team for Tassie. We're up in Queensland. We've gone through all the Nationals. Missed block out has equaled is three defensive slides just straight away. Kid you not, middle of the game, missed block out, foul on an offensive rebound. And we see it on the film just quickly off to the baseline. Bang, 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 three slides, line up for the foul shot. One of the best things that I just turned and looked at my assistant and I was trying not to laugh. But, you know, good on that person for getting that done. They stay consistent.
That's awesome. When you know you've made an impact as a coach. Like when middle of the game, they can still sit there and say, look, I'm just going to have to knock these out pretty quickly. And look, maybe very smart from the player knowing, geez, if I don't do this, I'm going to hear about this from Darren. I'll just go and fall on my own sword here and see if we can knock this over. I like that.
Yep. I like that. But those things can help. You know, so you get those things in and it's player-led, you know, and some of them definitely more on the boys' side. They're probably quick to dob each other in for not doing it. But, you know, it builds that stuff. They just know it's an expectation straight away. Like, what are your D-trans rules if you're in the half court? Are you tagging up? If not, miss tag up, three slides straight away, get that done. So that can help.
Yep, I completely agree with you. I think that's a really good way of doing it. There are going to be a lot of three-slide kids over the next couple of weeks, I suggest, with games resuming and missed box outs being front of mind, I would suggest. So one of the things that we do have a lot of at the moment is we have our training time and we have coaches that are potentially not at a club that has a club-wide offense, so to speak. So they're trying to work out what works for their kids, how are they going to run things during this year. How do you make it so that you are being efficient with potentially putting in an offense with your athletes?
In grading. So I would, depending on the age group, so I'd like to think that the offense for under 12s wouldn't be the same for under 18s. So it might be a similar structure, but not as much information, not as much rules. It'd be just a scale back version. Because if you put too much structure in, I believe, in under 12s, in particular, they end up becoming those robots that just try, because they're trying so hard to remember all the things that they're supposed to do rather than just letting basketball override and let them play. So from an under 12s perspective, it'd be, you know, I'd break down whatever those concepts are that are within the offense and play them at a 2-on-2, 3-on-3 sort of small-sided game. I'd do this all the way up to 18s, to be honest, but that's how I would introduce it. So break down one side of the floor. If there's a second side of the floor action, depending on the age group, I'd break that down as well before then putting it together rather than just, 5-on-0, you go to there, you go to there, you go to there. Let them play it a bit, see if they can find their own reads. If they can't find their own reads, so let's say there's a back cut option that they haven't figured out themselves, I'll manufacture that. So I'll go to the defense and say, I want you to jump, like quietly, I want you to jump in this lane and just see, you know, let them discover that read and things like that. But I mean, ideally, that's how I would do it. I wouldn't have too much of an issue in grading of taking the time with that, especially if it's a read, react, motion based sort of principle offense. So isolating whatever your actions are in small-sided games and then putting it together. So then ultimately the whole session actually feels like playing a game. And then, like you said before and what Darren said before, you can then coach both sides of the ball. You know, you can start whilst you're in those isolated concepts, you can start putting in your rules of how you guard the ball, how you guard off the ball, are you denial, are you pack, whatever you're doing. So, you're getting efficiency. There are a lot of, you know, some clubs are blessed with a two-hour training time. Some only get an hour. Some, you know, it all varies. So that's how I'd be, as I suppose, efficient as possible with putting a structure as such in place.
Yep. And how important is it, Darren, to have something that will be fairly usable, I suppose, for lack of a better term, against zone or man? It's, you know, that's, you're going to see a bit of zone, I would suggest, in trials, but do you want to have two separate offenses for that, or are you trying to find something that will suit both?
Well, I think any coach who is worth their salt at the older age group should have something that has at least similar concepts. So let's say you had a 3-out-2 in zone offense, you know, do you have a man offense that has maybe role replace posts, for example? Are your receiver principles the same? Are your offensive rebound rules the same against a zone or a man? I think those things make it easier, and similar principles when the ball's put on the floor and effectively your offense is broken, where does everybody get to? A lot of them are the same. And I think also having the ability to shift in and out of them, and it doesn't actually have to be identified whether it's a man or zone. I know for myself as a coach, as we're coming down the court, I'm yelling out, it's a zone, but the players may not have seen that yet. Where if you have something that can work against either, at least initially until there's a timeout or a break in play, that would be beneficial.
Yep.
I'm going to go off topic just for 2 seconds. Okay. So just because of what we're talking about here. So question to either of you, what do you run against a box in one or a triangle in two? Your man offense or your zone offense?
Okay, well, that's different. I would go by man offense, personally. But it sort of depends a little bit on who my two are. Like if both of my two that are being mashed up are both posts, I may not. I might just go and throw them both in corners and say, we'll play 3-on-3 and we'll see how it plays out. So you're going to get some junk there, I suppose, but yeah. I would probably be more likely to go with my man offense. What about you, Bestie?
Yeah, same. I've played against the box and one. I think the best thing to become is a screener yourself if you're the one person, because there's obviously your team has they're looking for you anyway if you're the primary option. So that opens up slipping and those types of options. But yeah, I would stick with mostly man against the box and one, provided, you know, obviously you've got to have a level of shooting. That's why they do it. Yeah. So you've got to have a good level of shooting on the rest of the team to get it done.
You may have given up a couple of my
Apologies. Yeah, sorry.
No, it's all right. I can edit this out afterwards if anyone happens to play me in grading.
I thought it was a little thing to throw
in. It's
got nothing to do with grading. But
well, it might though, to be honest, because this is the time of year where you're probably more likely to see a little bit of junk. And sometimes it's inadvertent junk defences where, you know, you just haven't quite got your shell or your makeup right yet. And all of a sudden you've just got some random kid thinking you're in man-to-man when you're actually supposed to be in zone or vice versa, and it becomes a box and one just by default because it's all gone wrong. So you do need to be a little bit mindful about what it looks like, and, you know, do you have to instruct your athletes, or are they smart enough to work that out yourself? Like sometimes, as coaches, we're probably more likely to see it first. I mean, we pay more attention to the coach down the other end. We hear the change-up coming, or we're probably more aware that they've called a timeout. Something's going to be different coming out of this. It's not going to be the same thing. So we're probably more likely to be aware of it. But I think much to what Darren was saying before, like you want it to a point where even if it is different, your players can run something that is going to at least be efficient and get you through, and not just be, we're just going to cough the ball up and hope for the best.
Yeah.
So
I think, yeah, everyone talks about style of play, which isn't your system of play, right? Yeah. So they're very different. But I would assume whatever it holds true for your style of play, which is basically your shot selection for your man, would be very similar to what it would be, if not exactly the same, for your zone. So regardless of what you're running, the types of shots you're wanting in the section of the shot clock or of your possession would still be the same. So if your group knows that, hopefully you're not ending up with junk being thrown up anyway.
Yep.
And here's a hot tip. Most teams will, 16s and 18s, will zone a baseline out of bounds.
Yep.
So there you go.
Just
you can take that.
Once again, thank you.
Oh,
I'll
sorry.
Edit that out. That's okay. No, we'll make this work. That's okay. No problem.
So
we'll
rename this podcast.
Yeah.
Scout.
Yeah.
Exactly right. Be the most predictable coach in Victoria at the end of this thing. So that's all right. But it is something we have to be mindful of with our players as well. But as coaches, we have to be careful too of how much we give our players. Like if we're going to roll out a 15-page playbook all before grading, we can't expect our players to be any good at this. They're going to butcher that entire thing. They might get one or two things right, and that's probably it. So how much you give them is really important. So like you were saying before, Zoe, the under-12s, you may give them some scaffolding with, you know, once the pass goes, fill the weak side corner and then we'll see what happens from that. It might be a drag on ball or whatever comes from that point. But there can be a little bit more for the older kids. But just because you're not giving it all to them doesn't necessarily mean you don't need to know it as the coach either. Like you might have something in your back pocket with, you know, 3-point game, you know, minute to go. You need to have something that you can potentially run with your kids if you have a timeout or an opportunity to run something as well. So you may need to be across it. Doesn't necessarily mean the players need to be across it this early on. Like I'd hate to think we have coaches out there. Apologies if you are one of these coaches, but I'd hate to think we have coaches out there running quick hitters at the moment for just in case we need a last-second play. Like that's really not what VJBL should be about to start off with, but it's not what this time of year should be about either. This time of year, should be getting back on court.
I think with whatever your system is, it's important to have common starting floor spots. You know, so when you see people that run predominantly set-based offenses and not conceptual offenses, sometimes they'll have totally different alignments for different sets, which makes it very difficult, confusing, and hard to flow on for and build on quickly. So if you have consistent floor spots that the kids are used to or the athletes are used to working with, very easily in a timeout, you can maybe put in that next action where if, let's say, it was a loaded side, it might be a little rub screen or it might be something different that could very easily be drawn up at halftime that just continues to build, as opposed to, here's one play that I saw from Michigan State on the weekend and they run a 1-4 high. And then here's another one that I saw Cairns Taipans running in the NBL Blitz this weekend and it's a totally different alignment. You know, so you've got to have consistent floor spots and think about your system and how it evolves over the year.
I think with like scenario work, I think there's a place for that at the older age groups to get them to start to think themselves, because obviously there always comes a time where the coach becomes irrelevant at the end of a game, like we don't have a timeout or we don't have the opportunity to put something in, so they'll need to make decisions on their own or you know, talk in a huddle on their own or whatever that might be. So I think there is room for that. There's definitely not room for that in under 12s and under 14s, and it's definitely not something that should take up your entire training session. It needs to be just, you could do a different one to end each session, you know, like just a real quick, hey, lights, you're up 4 with a minute to go, dark ball, quick 15-second timeout, play. And that's the last thing you do at the end of your practice, just as a little, because the athletes do actually love doing it, trying to figure it out. And it's really good for you as a coach as well to be able to say, see, it's not that easy. So you might need to listen if you've got one that doesn't listen. But, yeah, it's not something you should be spending a lot of time on, but expose them to it in probably, I would say, 18s definitely, maybe toward the end of their under 16s year.
Yep. I think it's something as well, and one thing I'm probably going to do a little bit more of this year as well, I think, is bringing the whiteboard to practice and just diagramming something random to start a scrimmage. Like just getting them used to learning something off a whiteboard where they've never seen it, they've never practiced it, they just have to go out and try and execute and just find out which kids are capable of that, which kids aren't capable of that, which ones are going to grossly struggle with it but can get there eventually, like what spots kids need to be in. I think because that is a skill, like learning something off a whiteboard. It might not be something that you ever use again, but it might be in case of throwing the ball up on a jump ball play. We're going to start with this hit off a sideline and just see what happens. And then you get to sort of scratch your itch as well as a coach, because we all enjoy like diagramming plays and things like that. But you kind of find out a little bit more about your kids too, which I think can be really valuable. And if you ever need that play, well, they've at least seen it before and can potentially translate it too.
Yeah, so, it's a skill we don't really I don't think as coaches we put time into. And I'm not saying that I put time into it. I don't really do it either. It's something that kind of gets pushed to the side because we've got so much other stuff to do. But I think, yeah, definitely a worthwhile skill to be able to, you know, I think we've all, any coach that's coached more than one season knows that there's always been a time where we've drawn something up and then out they go and one or two athletes is doing something completely different. And that's not their fault. They may not, if they haven't seen it before, and if we haven't worked on that skill of you've got a short amount of time to absorb what's being written here and then you've got to put it out there. Which way do you hold your whiteboard in a timeout?
This is a good one because this is what I was going to talk about because I also think that the coaches need to practice it.
Yep.
Coaches need to practice what they're doing and how they do it. You know, there was one point where, you know, we've all gone through different methods where we write numbers, maybe we write initials. You know, at one point I looked on my board and I had four J's because, you know, we had four players. I'm like, well, that's not going to work. All right, so now we've got to go with something different. I actually think progressing your play along the board is better than actually rubbing it out. So if you've got your typical sort of, oh, no one can see this on the podcast.
Brilliantly done, bestie.
No, just for you guys because I'm going to check you guys as well, right? So if you've got your typical board that's got, you know, your full court on one side and a half court on the other side, that your play should actually progress and then you flip it and then you finish on that one as you go as opposed to rubbing out because it can get quite confusing and the players can see lines sort of going everywhere. So practicing those, particularly, you know, old age groups, late game stuff is super important because it's an intense moment. So you've got to have those things practiced and ready to go.
Have you ever used the magnets, bestie, when you were on whiteboards? Or you've always steered clear of that?
Yeah, yeah, can't stand the magnet.
Yeah, I'm the same. I get lost.
Yeah.
Like I know my whiteboards do tend to look like a very bad Picasso at the end of it sometimes with lines going everywhere, but geez, the magnets confuse me.
Well, sometimes you can't figure out, you forget how that magnet got there.
Yeah,
like, absolutely. Where did I come from?
Yep, you know? I've done that plenty of times. It's like, so all of a sudden we'll have an overload on this side and it's like, where'd the sixth player come from? Like, what happened here? Like, how have I managed to screw this up? So, but
do you hold whiteboard facing, so north-south, like as in, in line with your head, or do you hold it the side,
like
along the same level as the court?
Yeah, I'm north-south. Yeah. And it's, I mean, we talk about players screwing this up and you were somewhat optimistic when you only said one or two may screw this up. but I have messed myself up plenty of times where I've diagrammed on the wrong end and it didn't make sense to me. And I've actually had a player say, you're going to have to do that again. Mm. Like, because I held the whiteboard the wrong way for what they were used to me doing it with. And, you know, that's probably on me a little bit because I haven't adjusted or made them adaptable enough to be able to read a whiteboard. But by the same token, dude, you're in the post. Go and screen. Like, it's, you know, it's not that complicated as well. So
consistency of symbols as well. You know, I think, you know, what is a dotted line with an arrow? Like, we know it as a pass, but what do they know it as? You know, like, I think those things are important as well.
Yep. And late game, how many times do you go to draw a line and you're a bit nervous and all of a sudden look like a dribble instead of a cut? And like, it's that sort of stuff as well. We have to be really mindful that our players know what that is. So if you are going to go through grading, you've potentially got a new team that you haven't had before, these are the kind of things your players will need to know. And this is not necessarily going to help win you a game straight away, but it is part of the player's ongoing education about the sport too. It's not easy. They can't just roll in and be good straight away. They have to do a little bit of work there to make sure that they can actually compete at that level as well. One thing you do need to be mindful of as coaches though, obviously how the grading system works, but also what things like point spread are, head-to-head matchup, three-way ties, what's it look like on that, where upsets are going to happen, those kinds of things. Be across it. Make sure you've got it written down somewhere. I recommend don't put it on your whiteboard because I've done that before and I rubbed it out by accident after I'd finished a timeout and it's like, damn, was it 12? Like, we had to win by 12 or was it 11 and under? So piece of paper in your pocket. If you are getting to that third game of the little grading pool, make sure you know your situation. We'd all love to be in the situation where we've won enough games and the result doesn't matter and we know we're going through, but make sure you've got a little bit of an idea as to what that is.
Yeah, so. I'm not sure there's... I think this year might be a bit different and I don't think there are crossovers pre-Christmas. Correct me if I'm wrong.
I think you're right.
But normally or, you know, next year, obviously know as well if you're going to have to play in that game because often, you know, you can then say straight after your game, hey, we'll have a crossover next week, you know, so it just keeps them, you know, engaged in what they're doing, especially in grading phase one. Because as soon as you're done with grading phase one, athletes are going, great, school's about to end and it's Christmas. So, you know, if you can keep them engaged or as engaged as possible by just knowing that they've got the game the next week and nothing changes and we're at practice and all that sort of stuff, it just keeps them in that routine and that mindset.
And grading throws up crazy results. Like the amount of times where you go and beat a team by 20, they beat another team by 20, then that team beats you by 20. It's like, how did this happen? Like, what is going on here? And, you know, there's all sorts of other things that may have gone on with, you know, potentially school camps and that sort of stuff, which can throw your grading into chaos anyway. So,
and check that, take a screenshot of the ladder before you have your last game, because they'll take the ladder down, which rightly so, because you don't want people making up their crossovers and things like that. But take the screenshot so you know who's done what and when, and then you can figure out what's to next.
Yep, very good. One other part of this time of year that we probably haven't touched on is the social aspect for our athletes. They haven't been around each other. They're potentially playing for a new team. We do need to put a little bit of time and effort into making sure our team is a team and they know each other, they know how each other ticks and those kinds of things too. So whilst there's a lot that goes on the court, which is absolutely valuable, I'm certainly not shelving that by any means, do take some time to have your team get to know each other as well, because they are going to spend potentially 8 or 9 months together over the course of this next year. They have to get along. They have to know each other. They have to be okay in each other's company as well. So please do spend some time with your athletes socially, not necessarily you as the coach, but make sure they have the opportunity socially to interact a little bit as well, and they can get to know each other, because, you know, we've had 2 years where socially it's through a computer screen, and that's probably about as good as it gets. So their ability to communicate and those kinds of things, you might do like a little treasure hunt or, you know, amazing race type thing just to get them sort of bonded a little bit and have a little bit of fun with the kids as well. So, you know, as always, don't forget, basketball is supposed to be fun for everyone. Not always the case, I understand, but this does have to be fun for everyone. And with the last 2 years, I think we have a real duty as coaches to make sure that basketball is fun for our athletes.
Yeah, I think with those, you know, if you're going to do sort of bonding exercises or things like that, just make sure you split the clicks. There'll always be clicks, and it's not necessarily a bad thing. Some people just like other people better than others. Like, and it's not, we always sort of, I don't know why we do it. We make out that everybody has to, you know, the old Jackie Moon, you know, everybody love everybody all the time. It's not going to be the case. But as long as they get to know each other on a level that means that your team works, you know, they don't have to sleep over at each other's houses all the time or do, you know, be that close. But they just have to be respectful of each other and understand each other and things like that. So if they can, you know, if you split the clicks up with that sort of stuff, then they start to get to know each other. But there is nothing wrong with a couple of kids that like each other more than they like the rest of the team, as long as it doesn't become detrimental, as long as they don't separate themselves from the group. And by splitting them in your bonding exercises, it gives them a chance to get to know other athletes. It's really important if you've got new athletes in your team from like other clubs or, you know, have just started playing or whatever it might be. It can be really daunting walking into a new group, having been at another club. So I think as coaches, we can put some time into that and help that process along. And what you'll find is the more they get to know each other and, you know, enjoy each other and have some fun, that will translate to the floor. So you will start to see better results as a result of those athletes getting to know each other as well.
Bestie, what's your best pre-season getting to know each other activity? Do you have them in the beach, like linking arms as the waves crash over them, or have you got something
SAS
better?
Styles?
Yeah. Well, I think it depends on the age group. You know, like I think the older the age group, the last couple of years I've coached 18s, typically there's a core group that's been together for a while, and the first one is more goal setting for them, and they determine with what they want to achieve and how we're going to do it, and that's for me where we came up with those rules around 3 slides from this block out, and that way it's all set. But with the younger age groups, it needs to be something more social, break down some barriers, you know, whether it's like you said, hitting the beach or adventure park or something like that is always good. It just develops a level of care. So the more you know someone, the more you care about them, and then you're more willing to see them succeed and become a little less selfless or more selfless, yes.
Coaches, good luck with your grading. Like it's coming thick and fast. Like it's before you know it, you'll be through grading and in Christmas, and then not too long after that, we'll be back, and then, you know, on court and Australia Day tournaments and all those kinds of things too, and we'll be dealing with the never-ending wave of injuries, no doubt, coming our way as well, and how we manage that too. So, coaches, good luck with your grading. Thanks, Dan Giancino, for throwing us a topic. Coaches, if you are listening to this and there is a topic that you would like us to cover, by all means, reach out, and we will do some work on that. We have a special guest on the podcast next week. Dr. Julia Walsh is joining us again to talk motivation and communication with our athletes, which is vital for our athletes in particular this time of year. So make sure you're tuning in for that one. Bestie, thank you very much for jumping in. First pod, you will definitely get a round two. No problem. You've done very well on that. It's a significant upgrade on Ash. So
He's turned up, so it's a significant upgrade on Coop.
That's true. Like two for two. Like we have a low bar here, Bestie, and you have jumped over it comfortably, thankfully. Zoe, appreciate you jumping in as well.
Thank you.
Coaches, good luck with your coaching. Good luck with grading, and we will catch everyone next week on the podcast. Look, tune in, join the tribe on iTunes and Spotify.